Leffler.
Please report, counsel. Good morning, my name is Steve Leffler, and I'm sure you can tell from the filings that I'm an 11th hour hire, but I come prepared to discuss this case. Before I do, however, discuss Mr. Carter's case, I would rest for a moment, and it will truly be less than a minute. As I'm in the twilight of my career, it's nice to be reminded how special it is to appear before this body. As I get older, I can't drive, and so my friend Larry Goldstrom drove me down, and I can't tell you how excited he was to be here to listen to this. The citizens really respect you and what you do, and it's nice to be reminded of that. Since we fight sometimes and we have disagreements, it's nice for me to hear the citizenry be so excited. And so now I'm done pandering to the court, and I'll address this particular case. Mr. Carter does raise some interesting issues. The first thing I want to talk about is, does the court have jurisdiction? I know that the state has raised some concern about whether or not these two cases are properly before the court. I would ask this court to consider that the Glass case, which is cited in Mr. Carter's brief and discussed by the state, does seem to be controlling. While I understand the Glass case was an appeal to the district court, the facts are so similar that I think that this court does have jurisdiction. The second point I would make here is that, with all respect, if in fact you had serious concerns about whether or not jurisdiction was before you, you could have easily tossed this case prior to scheduling it for argument. And if there were any procedural irregularities, not afraid to do that. So it makes me think that there might be some issues that concern you that you'd like to deal with. And as Mr. Carter, I think he did a pretty good job in his brief, as he mentioned, this might be an opportunity for this court to address whether or not an appeal has to be made when a request to proceed in form of populace is denied by the lower court. And the final point I'd make on the issue of jurisdiction is that to deny jurisdiction in this case actually defeats the purpose of the statute. The statute wants to allow poor people to have access to the court, and assume for the moment that the lower court judge has made a mistake. Well, then you are effectively barring that individual from appealing and appearing before this august body. To address now the merits of the case, I would submit that I think Mr. Carter's arguments are relatively novel. He's saying that since the Smith case, the 2011 Smith case, that kind of changed the landscape of murder, I guess manslaughter, second degree murder, in that an intentional act resulting in murder under the right provocation, on what an ordinary, reasonably prudent person would consider to be proper provocation, that could be manslaughter, not second degree anymore. And then he takes it a step further and says that under this Allen case, and I'm not sure, it's the A-L-L-E-N-Y-E, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I discussed this with counsel, and we're hoping that we both mispronounce it if we are, in fact, that this Allen case has come along and has broadened the Apprendi reach so that not only do maximum penalties need to be considered by the jury, but so should minimum penalties be considered by the jury. Admittedly, Allen is in some United States Supreme Court case, but I do think that I will address a point that the state made here, that Mr. Carter did file within 1 year of the Allen case. So we are arguing and submitting to this court that the Allen case has substantially changed the law, and therefore Mr. Carter does fall within that 1 year grace period of, I think one of the arguments the state was making is that, well, the Smith case came out in 2011, and therefore he should have filed within that 1 year period of time. I don't think it kicks in until the Allen case comes down the pipe in 2013. So Mr. Carter's within that 1 year period of time.
The time bar.
Go
The time barred issue was not raised at the trial level?
Absolutely.
But was there an opportunity to raise it at the trial
level? That would be the argument that I was submitting to the court, is that there was not an opportunity.
To discuss it there?
That's correct. Okay. Because the judge summarily determined that it was frivolous, and therefore the poverty affidavit didn't apply.
Thank you.
Counsel, I was going to ask you, wasn't the State versus Smith argument raised by your client in a prior post-conviction motion?
I'll be honest with the court. I think I did good work in a couple of days trying to get real familiar with this particular case. I know that's an argument that the State made. I can't answer that one way or another, whether it was done, because I know he had successive post-conviction applications. And as well, I don't want to tell you anything.
Assume for purposes of my question that he did raise Smith in a prior post-conviction that's final and was denied. What do you think that this Elaine or Allen or however you pronounce that case adds that wasn't there via Apprendi and Smith?
Well, honestly, that's the question I was worried about as I was coming down. I would submit to you, sir, that if the Allen case was in existence, my client could have, at the time of the trial, and I realize that was a long time ago, he could have determined to take the stand. I know that he chose not to take the stand, and this court, in the first Carter case, made reference to that. However, I think that had he had the opportunity, had the law been different, had Smith been in existence back when the trial occurred, he could have taken a stand and it could have at least raised the issue of whether or not there was a quarrel. Now, I don't agree with my client when he says that he thinks the state has to prove there wasn't a quarrel, but I think that that whole issue should have been addressed, and I am hopeful that this court will determine that Allen makes this retroactive because this was a case that was on appeal.
Now, it's my understanding that the federal courts that have considered Allen's retroactivity have essentially all held that it's not retroactive. Do you have any help for us on that issue?
I can tell you that the Eighth Circuit has determined it's not retroactive. I know that there's one circuit that is not clear yet on whether or not they've come to a decision, but unfortunately I do have to grant you that it does appear to be the majority of the districts are determined that it's not retroactive.
Thank you.
So if that were the case, then you don't get a new day one, so to speak.
Unfortunately, that's true, Your Honor. Now, go back to my argument that I addressed with His Honor, I do think it becomes important to consider what information Mr. Carter had at the time of his original trial, because there is testimony and evidence in the record that there might have been a quarrel. The people were in the two cars right next to each other. Then much later, not much later, but later in time, when they were at the garden of Mr. McKay's, and there was a question that baseball bat was being thrown, there is arguably an opportunity to argue that there was some sort of provocation that the ordinary, reasonably prudent person could respond to. And I'm hoping that this court might use this as an opportunity to determine whether or not the automatic step instruction of first degree, second degree, and manslaughter should still continue to be used. Maybe under the Smith case, and even if you determine that Allen is not retroactive, so you'll probably not deal with it, but I would ask you to consider it. Maybe it makes sense sometimes for the trial court to give a murder instruction and not give second and give a manslaughter when there appears to be some rational basis for a provocation defense. I've got about a minute left, and I'd like to save that if I could, unless there's any questions for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Klein, good morning.
And please support Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. Honors, I'd like to address the jurisdictional issue first, just because it's sort of an oddball case. We've got two appeals essentially arising out of a single post-conviction. The post-conviction that generated all of this was filed May 28th, and ultimately on November 18th, 2014, the district court entered an order dismissing the post-conviction, finding the claims were either had been raised or were knowable to have been raised or don't establish facts or law that would constitute a violation of the Constitution and therefore make his conviction void. The defendant filed a notice of appeal on December 4th and did not file an application to proceed in form of papyrus on this. And somehow, I don't know exactly how this happened, but on December 22nd, a second order was entered by the district court finding the motion, the post-conviction motion, to be frivolous, which essentially triggers application of Nebraska Revised Statute 25-2301.02, which states that if the district court on its own motion finds the application to be frivolous, then it has to provide the requisite reasons for it, which it did. And if the objection, as it's referred to in the statute, is sustained, which, since it's the court's own motion, is pretty much likely to be the case, then the party filing the appeal has 30 days after the ruling to either proceed with an action or appeal upon payment of fees, costs, or security, which was not done in this case. Therefore, that, to me, raised the question of whether or not there is jurisdiction in these cases, and based on the fact that there was no payment of costs or fees and not even an application to proceed in form of papyrus, which, frankly, based on the court's finding of the frivolous legal positions which were put forth in the petition, would likely be rendered essentially moot as a result of the application of 25-2301.02. Therefore, I raise the jurisdictional question. It seems to me, based on this peculiar set of facts, that the defendant did not vest jurisdiction in this court.
That's because he didn't file an application to proceed in form of papyrus?
It's because, well, I don't think even if he had filed an application to proceed in form of papyrus based on 25-2301.02, that would have vested jurisdiction either based on the court's lower court's finding that the legal positions advanced in the post-conviction action were frivolous. As you read down that statute, they say if the objection is sustained, then the party filing the application has 30 days after the ruling to either proceed with an action or appeal upon payments of fees, costs, or securities. And frankly, nothing was done at that point by the defendant. So,
how do you synthesize our ruling in Glass v. Kenny with that?
Well, as I understand Glass versus Kenny, that was an interlocutory appeal because the application for in form of papyrus was to proceed at the district court level. And basically, we went through the district court level, whether or not there was a proper application or not. The district court essentially ruled on the merits of the thing. So whether or not there was a proper IFP application at the district court is kind of, at least in my mind, rendered inconsequential or moot because of the fact that the district court went ahead and made its ruling on the merits of this. Out of an abundance of caution, I guess, I'd like to address the Allen or Elaine or however it's pronounced issue. I don't think that has any application in this case. Elaine is essentially it's a variation on the Apprendi theme, and it's pretty fact-specific. Elaine was convicted of robbery, and there was an additional charge relating to a firearm that went to the jury, and there were three options for the jury. If they found that the defendant had used or carried a firearm, then that would result in essentially a five-year penalty. If he had brandished the firearm, that would be a seven-year penalty, and if it had been discharged, that would be a 10-year penalty. Well, the jury came back and found that it had been simply carried in the course of the underlying robbery, which means that there is a five-year additional penalty for it. Well, the judge essentially overruled it and found that it had been brandished and said, no, it's going to be 7 years, and the United States Supreme Court said, no, you've got a specific factual finding made by the jury, which it is not only empowered but entitled to do under Apprendi, because it essentially boosts the mandatory minimum for the offense. And when you've got that factual finding that's binding on the court, it can't essentially overrule the jury based on its interpretation of the facts. I don't think that has anything to do with the defendant's case, certainly because Elaine is 25 years after the defendant was convicted in this case, and I find no indication that Elaine is intended to be retroactively applied, and therefore I think it's basically got nothing to do with this case. Unless there are additional questions, we would ask that the district court's ruling of dismissal be... Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
We have a minute and 1 second.
A minute and 1 second, Mr. Leffler.
Thank you. I actually don't have anything to add. The way you folks have no questions. Appreciate the courtesy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day is State versus Larry F. Duncan. Justice Stacy is recused in this case, and she's also recused in the last case of the day. Mr. Elliott, good morning to you. You may approach.
I'm not going to reserve any rebuttal time. I'm Sean Elliott, Public Defender's Office.